You know, I've been a member of Unitarian Universalist congregations since 1991, but I don't ever remember hearing about the empowerment controversy until I went to seminary 10 years later. Even then, the story, with all of its confusing acronyms, Buck, Bach, Bawa, Fullback, seemed as distant and obscure to me as 18th century history lessons did when I was in high school. And then I started meeting the African-American ministers in our movement, and everything changed. UU ministers and seminarians of color gather each year for a weekend retreat. This year, we're all going to Atlanta at the end of this month. The first thing we do when we gather during our opening worship is to call the ancestors, those who have gone before us, who have dug the wells from which we drink. The names of UU ministers of color rise from our voices, the ones who have passed away, but also the ones who could not find a seat at our table. Qualified African American, Asian American, Latino, Latina ministers who felt the institution's discomfort with them and chose another path. Through their eyes, through their tears, I have come to understand the events of the empowerment controversy to be one more link in the continuous chain of promises and possibilities, hopes and disappointments that stretch from the earliest days of our denomination's history to this very present moment. Many irresistible forces collided with many immovable objects in that General Assembly meeting hall in Boston, 1969. Out of all of those forces, two were particularly influential. First, the weak theological grounding of the newly formed UUA, and second, the rise of the Black Power movement in the United States. The values held by the nascent institution of the UUA and the values held by African American UUs collided during the years of the empowerment era. And because we shared no deep religious practices, no religious values or understanding, most of them, could not move beyond our differences. Unitarian Universalism is at once a very old religion and a very new religion. Some people say that our origins go all the way back to, Origen, the first century Egyptian Christian scholar. I think it's more useful to say that today's Unitarian Universalism is a new religion with very old, old family roots. The UUA was created in 1961 as a result of the consolidation of the American Unitarian Association and the Universalist Churches of America. The first half of the 20th century had dealt serious blows to both of these liberal Christian denominations. Both had seen steady declines in membership and closing of church doors. The Unitarians, with their optimistic onward and upward progressive gospel, could not respond to the evils of World War II, World War I, and the Holocaust. The Universalists lost members as other mainline Protestant denominations adopted their ideas of universal salvation. But their responses to this decline were different, very, very different. The Unitarians responded to declining membership and the closing of churches by restructuring the institution to make it more efficient and reorganizing processes to cut costs. The Universalists, on the other hand, responded to those same challenges by delving deeper into their theology. Robert Cummins, General Superintendent of the Universalist Church, started the conversation with this bold statement: Universalism cannot be limited to either Protestantism or to Christianity, not without denying its very name. Ours is a world fellowship, not just a Christian sect. The younger ministers especially were energized by this opening of possibilities. A new universalism would be a religion that was spiritually nourishing for the entire world. And so they set about on their work to shaping existing traditions for a new time and a new reality. Neither of the denomination's strategies worked. The Unitarians and the Universalists came together in May 1961 because their survival was at stake. They knew that there were major theological differences separating them, but they could not bear to talk about those differences for fear that conflict would emerge and the merger would collapse. David Bumbaugh was one of those people standing in the hall that day when the vote came. In a convocation lecture he gave last month at Meadville Lombard Seminary, Reverend Bumbaugh reflected on that very moment, saying, "I was overwhelmed by the sense that something profoundly important had just died. That I had just voted away my religious home, that I had just witnessed the end of the Universalist movement." In the ensuing years, the Universalist hope of delving deeper into theological questions gave way to the more powerful Unitarian agenda, the building of the institution as an end unto itself. Instead of theology, the UUA chose instead to dedicate itself to a liberal political agenda that included three closely related ideologies. One, our identity as rescuer. Two, the democratic process. And three, individualism. These values fit perfectly into the liberal social and political fervor of the 1950s and 60s. When that telegram came to 25 Beacon Street from Dr. Martin Luther King, urging all religious leaders to join him in Selma in 1965, 40 UU ministers immediately answered the call, and then hundreds and hundreds joined after them, after one of them, James Reeb, was killed. In a lecture given at the 2004 SUSE stands for Southeast UU Summer Institute, Davidson Lohr described the civil rights era as a time of great excitement for UUs. The spirit of liberal religion, he said, couldn't compare in relevance, excitement, or moral clarity to the spirit of liberal politics. White liberals felt virtuous for their good efforts, and the role of liberals would then be to speak up for victim groups, to accept with gratitude their chosen victim groups, and to accept the gratitude of those victim groups, and to feel virtuous for their efforts. In the absence of God, in the absence of a ground of being, or whatever is worthy of worshiping as the ultimate value in life, it was easy to use other people as an instrument of our salvation. In the absence of an individual identity deeper than ego, and a collective identity thicker than a loose confederation of like-minded people, it was easy to use other people to chase away our ongoing doubts about our self-worth. The problem with this effort to shore up our self-worth through other human beings was that it required a steady flow of victims to be rescued, and the civil rights movement provided what must have seemed like an inexhaustible supply of such victims. And on the whole, at least for a while, these victims showered their rescuers with praise and appreciation. In the absence of an ultimate value, the democratic process became our holy ground. Democratic process became not merely a civic virtue, but rather the fundamental basis for human relating. The battle for equality and voting rights fit right into this value. And once again, white UUs could feel virtuous in defending a deeply held belief by coming to the rescue of those who had been cast beyond the blessings of democracy. In the absence of a theological understanding of the human being as an innately social, interdependent being, the liberal virtue of secular individualism also became our holy ground. It too was a value that was well suited for the civil rights era. The UU worldview of an autonomous, self-reliant individual fueled our passion to work for the individual rights of the oppressed. Paul Raiser, in his essay, Liberal Theology and the Challenge of Racism, argues that liberals wanted to create a strong and inclusive community, but we often want to do it without giving up anything, without letting down the barriers we erect around ourselves in the name of individual autonomy. Within the secular ideologies of the democratic process and individualism, the role of rescuer was a bright and shining one. As long as the oppressed were powerless and, most importantly, thankful, all was well. All would be well. But the times, they were a-changin'. The awful roar of the waters were coming. Thunder and lightning were filling the skies. Just months after Selma, the Watts riots broke out. Malcolm X was killed. Martin Luther King would be next. Students were agitating. Blacks were agitating. Young people were rebelling. Women were rising up. And James Forman, one-time executive director of SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, nailed a copy of the Black Manifesto on the door of the Lutheran Church of America. He had been the keynote speaker at the 1969 National Black Economic Development Conference, where the participants had demanded that white Christian churches and Jewish synagogues pay $500 million in reparations to U.S. Negroes, or face the possibility of disruption of church operations and seizure of church facilities. These were the years of the Black Power movement. Stokely Carmichael and Charles Hamilton coined that phrase, Black Power, as, quote, a call for Black people to define their own goals, to lead their own organizations, and to support those organizations. It is a call to reject the racist institutions and values of this society. The concept of Black Power rests on the fundamental premise: before a group can enter the open society, it must first close ranks. By this, we mean that group solidarity is necessary before a group can operate effectively from a bargaining position of strength in a pluralistic society. Alex Poinsett, a longtime UU and member of BUCK, the Black UU Caucus, looks back on this time saying, I, too, had been radicalized by the murders of Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, and John F. Kennedy, disgusted by too many Black and white liberals so mortgaged to the establishment that they were unwilling to challenge it seriously. Using the words empowerment and self-determination, we argued that black people should take charge of the affairs affecting black people. No longer could white people tell us what our values should be and what is good for our communities. All of this energy, all of this turbulence that was building out on the streets in the United States was also building inside the UU movement. There were more African American UUs in churches than ever before. And so by the time that the emergency conference at the Biltmore Hotel in New York happened, there were already groups of organized black UUs all around the country. The rescuers and those they saw as victims of oppression were headed for a collision course. When the Black Affairs Council found out that their funding was on the agenda again at the 1969 General Assembly, after it had already been approved 1 year before, they were outraged. They demanded that the propriety of this do-over provision should be moved to the top of the agenda so they could take care of that first. But the UUA held fast to its insistence on the democratic process. A two-thirds majority was required to make any agenda changes. African-American delegates argued, "Our destiny as a people trumps your polity processes." And the white allies argued, "This is not a time for business as usual." But that vote of almost two-thirds mustered by the Black Affairs Council and its white allies didn't count. And because we had built a religion that said that the democratic process was the basis of our human relating, there was no place to go. There was no holy common ground, no higher authority, just the banalities of Robert's Rules of Order and the UUA bylaws. The UU self-image as rescuer ran into a wall of resistance. An African American community, no longer willing to play their assigned roles as victims of oppression, grateful for being rescued. Ione Vargas, a UU from New Hampshire, recalled during one meeting asserting that we were no longer white Negroes, that we were interested in building a collective system of black action, and that we were interested in the redistribution of power. The reception, she says, was very cold. Such speeches, she continues, usually were greeted this way. Perhaps the concepts were so new to white people vis-a-vis black that they just didn't know how to respond. They didn't know how to respond. There was no sense of an ultimate value that everyone could return to. There was no spiritual practice of forgiveness, atonement, reconciliation. There was no practice of deep listening, compassion, empathy. And so people left. They left their churches. They left their fellowships. They left longtime friends. Faced with the upset of its worldview, the UUA then went into a period of distortion and denial of reality. A robust theology enables a religious community to adjust to changes in existential realities. A weak one cannot handle the fear that those changes bring. The result of the conflict-averse, weak theology of the Unitarian Universalist during those years was that the feared rupture, the rupture that they feared due to the conflict, actually did happen. And this only reinforced the aversion to conflict. It also meant that we couldn't appreciate the value of disorientation, disruption, and breakdown that Donna Sequeira talked about yesterday. So instead, we're still living with the repercussions of that painful conflict. As the UUA Commission on Appraisal observed in 2005, on the whole, UUs just don't talk about theology. And yet, there has been progress and perseverance. The good news is that here in this congregation, like many others, we are actually talking about theology. We're talking about ultimate value. We're talking about the essential nature of the human being, about wounding and healing. We're talking about our lives and the pressing spiritual issues that confront us every single day. We are building a foundation of goodwill and trust. We are living out of a covenantal relationship, that relationship that will hold us, I pray, through the next storm that hits, and the one after that, and all the days in between. And we are talking about race, learning the slow expertise of opening up to each other as we did yesterday in our Black History Month program. Sally Kellen, she was so wonderfully inarticulate, and willing to be so, and asking in a halting fashion what we must do to have a conversation without it sounding patronizing. And Robert Vinson, sharing what it's like to be a Black parent choosing a white congregation and having this continual catch somewhere in the back of his head about whether his daughter is going to be all right here. And Mark Morrison Reed, our keynote speaker, his voice cracking with emotion, saying that no one is born a racist, no one is born a racist, and expressing tremendous hope and optimism for our religious movement. And the good news from the UUA is that it did remain true to its commitment to having African-American representation on all of its policy-making boards every single year since 1970. And thanks to congregational support at last October's Association Sunday, the UUA has raised funds to support seminarians and ministers of color in their work. So, not every collision of forces creates that perfect storm. Seamus Heaney's poem, The Cure at Troy, sings to us of refusing to be resigned, of believing that two forces can actually collide, refusing to be resigned, and to believe that two forces can actually collide to create something miraculous. History says, don't hope on this side of the grave. Don't hope on this side of the grave. But then, once in a lifetime, the long hoped for tidal wave of justice can rise up, and hope and history rhyme. What Unitarian Universalists dreamed and boldly tried in 1968 can still be ours to do. May we dare to hope again on this side of the grave. And again, and again, and again. Amen.